Good afternoon, Chief Justices. May it please the court, Santino Tricotti on behalf of the appellant, Eric Russell. The chief issue in this appeal is the admission of 3507 statements without appropriate foundation. Specifically in this case, we're dealing with the prong of the 3507 statement not touching on the events perceived. The record before the court is one where the judge could not have found, even in the exercise of discretion, that the complainant touched on the events because there was not a sufficient effort on direct examination about the allegations implicating Mr. Russell. As a result, there was no testimony that touched or even alluded to an event making up 5 of the 6 counts in the indictment.
Is it accurate that all of the accounts of the indictment were derived from what occurred in the bedroom after the HBO movie?
No, and in fact, that's what's at issue here. A review of the CAC out-of-court interview, Your Honor, reveals that some of the events, and it was a disjointed interview. We understand we are dealing with, younger witnesses. But when asked directly whether the events happened on that one occasion, the complainant responded in the negative. And that some of, the rape allegation was...
Who responded in the negative?
The complainant, okay, in her interview. In fact, it was the rape allegation that actually, she said, did not occur on that day. And so when we get to touching on the events perceived, based on the record, it appears that the prosecutor, possibly for strategic reasons, the intent really isn't important, but shut down the direct examination prematurely. There wasn't any resistance by the complainant during direct examination. She was not speaking in general terms. In fact, she was testifying specifically about one of the allegations.
I just want to be clear in my mind on this, but accepting what you're saying about the CAC interview, as far as the statement given to the mother, Smith, that event, everything occurred after the HBO movie?
The child statement to the mother?
Yes.
Yes. As far as...
My notes indicate that Dawn told Smith that Russell had put a nasty movie on or selected a movie off HBO demand. He was watching it with her, playing with his private in front of her. He also asked her to put her mouth on his private.
Right.
That was after the movie, right?
Yes. The problem is, with respect to the mother statement, Your Honor, there still wasn't any direct examination about those allegations, about the rape charge. What the mother was testifying to was that the complainant told her about allegations beyond the movie. The easiest way to do it is the movie events and the non-movie events. The complainant only testified about the movie events. That's why we challenged on appeal that the mother's testimony regarding the out-of-court statements was also in error.
Mr. Tricotti, I got the impression from the brief that there's only one statement that's at issue in this appeal, and that's the CAC videotape interview. Is that correct?
No, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, there are statements that the mother, through direct examination, discussed out-of-court statements that the complainant told her. Those are also challenged in our opening brief, and for the same reasons, that she did not touch on the events.
Let's take them one at a time.
Sure.
The CAC interview was videotaped, correct?
Yes.
Doesn't the fact that it was videotaped dispose of your claim that the testimony about it did not touch on the events perceived? or to put it differently, doesn't the Daley case control as far as that claim is concerned?
No. For one, the Daley case involves, and I guess I should add that the claim was 3513 and 3507 as vehicles to allow these statements in. Daley involves 3513, where this court was asked to interpret whether there's an extra element in 35 or a lack of an element in 3513 that has to be met. That's not relevant for this case because, for one, the complainant did touch on the statement. We can see that. The Daley case involves that element, whether they have to touch on the events. On the statement. The issue here involves the commonality in both 3513 and 3507, that the witness, whether they be a child or an adult, must still touch on the event perceived. Well, that's what's lacking.
Doesn't the Daley opinion, even if the Daley case involved testimony that the trial testimony that touched on the events perceived, doesn't that opinion go on to hold that the fact that the statement was videotaped is dispositive of that particular element of the required showing under 3513?
Respectfully, no. The in order for the videotaped statement to come in, this court has unequivocally held that the foundational requirements are required to be met. In Daley, there was at least an effort by the prosecutor to elicit. Now, for better or for worse, there are cases where the complainant minimally satisfies that requirement, whether it be general or vague testimony. But that assumes that the prosecutor is making an effort to elicit that out of direct examination. That's what's lacking here.
Well, if the language in the Daley opinion regarding the significance of the videotaping of the statement at issue doesn't dispose of the touching on the events perceived criterion, then what is the significance of that language?
The language in Daley?
In Daley.
With respect to the out-of-court statements being videotaped, I apologize. If you could repeat the question with respect to...
Well, I don't have a photographic memory either, but the argument was made by the state, in strong reliance on that case, and that's why I asked the question.
It's not that I have not read Daley, because it's cited in our briefs, and my recollection of Daley, and I also have the same, my memory also is not photographic, the reading of Daley is a comparison of 3513 and 3507. My understanding of that case does not involve the fact that because the statements are videotaped, the foundational requirements don't have to be met. And that's what this court recently held in as early as last month in Blake. The foundational requirements must be met because it runs the risk of having independent, unsworn statements come in as evidence to the crimes. If Daley were to stand for the proposition that because they're videotaped, you don't have to meet the foundation, then there'd be no reason to do the requirements.
Well, let's assume for purpose of argument, maybe obvious considering where we are today, that what Daley stood for was if there are two foundational requirements at issue, and one is the requirement to touch on the events perceived, and the other is to touch on the out-of-state statement itself, what Daley resolves under 3513, because there is no out-of-court statement requirement like there is under 3507, that if you introduce a videotape, it's a statement that speaks for itself, and the jury can assess it and compare that statement to what is testified to in court. But in any event, there's still a foundational requirement under both 3507 and 3513 that the witness touch on the events perceived.
That's exactly right.
That's my reading of Daley.
That's appellant's reading as well.
So where does that fit into your argument in this case?
The complainant did not touch on the events perceived. The prosecutor prematurely shut down shop on direct examination when there was no resistance or lapse of memory for the complainant to continue on. And the end result, Chief, is bringing in unsworn, independent evidence as the only evidence to the crimes alleged, which is precisely the reason this court in Blake found it problematic. Because as time and time again, what this court has held is that you cannot substitute live testimony. That is what Keyes, in fact, that's what Chancellor Quillen spent most of his concurring opinion on in Keyes, about the necessity of live testimony and the risk that you run when you substitute it for out-of-court statements. Because what you're lacking is the ability to compare for the jury the value of contradictions.
But if the witness has no memory or says, I don't remember, but the question invites an answer that if there was memory would touch on the events perceived, is it your position that that still does not qualify for admission?
No. That's a good point, Your Honor, and that's essentially Johnson. And Johnson says I believe Johnson and or Filecki, you know, deal with the fact of if there is a memory issue, does it still come in? That's fine. But in Your Honor's example, what's lacking here in comparison to the situation you pose is the effort by the prosecutor. Here, the prosecutor...
So there's a defect in the questioning rather than in the answer?
Yes, exactly. Because all we're going to be doing is engaging in speculation and conjecture.
Okay, and that defect is that the prosecution, as you put it, shut down the direct examination before the witness could touch on the events perceived.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And it's... You know, if you compare this case to Blake, although Blake dealt with the touching on the statements, here it's really touching on the event. It's touching on the events perceived. We're really in the same landscape. You're not allowing the jury the value to compare the statements to the in-court testimony. That's the problem here. Contrary to the state's argument that there were inconsistencies or contradictions, there weren't inconsistencies. Inconsistencies assume you have two things to compare. We don't have that here. We have the jury watching the CAC statements implicating the defendant on the most serious charges. Assume the following example, if I may. Assuming there was a defendant charged with two or more thefts, simple theft, a couple of shopliftings, and a robbery a day or two later. And the out-of-court statements talk about all the crimes. But the prosecutor, on direct examination, simply has the witness touch on the simple thefts. And then the court allows the statements to come in for the shopliftings and the robbery? That's what's happening here. They're getting everything in through the back door without any live testimony.
With regard to the prosecutor's question, there was questioning about touching. Did any part of his body touch any part of your body? Answer, yes. And then an explanation was given, which was essentially a different version of what had been given earlier. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Well, why isn't that a sufficient touching on the event in the bedroom? And then you just simply cross-examine vigorously about the inconsistencies.
Because not only is it irrelevant, it's an allegation that wasn't even the basis for one of the charges in the indictment. She, in her CAC statement, Your Honor, there she steadfastly denied that any privates touched her leg. And that's actually an interesting point because, again, without assuming what's going through the prosecutor's mind, I think it does raise an interesting, as far as the timing aspect, that after the complainant talks about an allegation that is not substantiated in the CAC statement and that isn't the basis for one of the charges in the indictment, the prosecutor decides she's had enough.
Well, can a, let's assume hypothetically, a turncoat witness that wants to switch sides for the defense and give a version of an event that may be a crime but a lesser crime than what was originally explained in the 3507 statement? Why isn't that sufficient to touch on the event?
Other than the fact that it's irrelevant and inflammatory and not the basis for any of the charges, that's not the events, that's not the material allegations at play also. This, you know, the example I gave with the shopliftings, you know, I guess it's almost, you know, everything can be, if you start linking things, even though they're weak links, you're going to get everything in through the back door.
Well, but, let's explore that for a minute. I'm not sure what you mean by inflammatory. I'm not sure what you mean by it not being material. But let's assume the turncoat witness to whom Justice Risley's referred gives the police a pretrial statement that the defendant committed a theft with a gun and therefore it on a person, and therefore it constituted a robbery. But then at trial denies that the defendant had a gun. Now, the events that he's touching on, the witness, concern all of the facts consistent with a robbery and consistent with a lesser-included offense of a theft or a lesser degree of robbery, but inconsistent with his original statement that said there was a gun. Does that still not constitute touching on the events perceived?
That certainly is a closer case, okay? That's a closer situation. The problem that we have here, Chief, is that when you contrast the CAC interview to the testimony, one thing is clear. The most serious charges in this indictment, which would be the rape and the other sexual assaults, occur on a different day. They, you know, she's asked by the CAC interviewer, did this occur when X, Y, and Z? And she says no. So those are separate allegations. And if you want to bring those in, but through out-of-court statements as unsworn independent evidence, you at least have to have an effort to touch on those. Or else we're back to the example with the thefts and the shopliftings, allowing the robbery to come in.
Well, I'm getting confused now. I thought the whole idea here under 3507 is that the witness has to be there to be able to first identify that, yes, I gave a statement and it was voluntary.
Yes.
The witness has to be asked, and did you tell the truth? To which they can answer yes or no, right?
Yes, exactly right.
Okay, and then the statement comes in, and the witness can be cross-examined because, hey, didn't you just say the opposite of what's in your statement?
Sure.
And that sort of thing. So if that's the way it works, why does it matter whether in the CAC statement she said something happened on a different day or something happened in a different fashion than what she says at trial? Those are just inconsistencies and perhaps untruths that are part of the whole process of reviewing what she's testifying to and what she told somebody out of court. Why does it matter whether she's talking about the what's currently being charged if it's the same overall sexual contact issue and now she's saying, well, it was a different thing? I'm not following your argument that that's an uncharged different crime.
Well, the fundamental problem with whether they touch on a minor, one of the lesser charges or the more severe charges, is the effect of the jury. Where's the live testimony regarding the allegations that implicate the defendant? If there's no attempt and there's no live testimony that results, the jury is left with simply the out-of-court unsworn statements as direct evidence. That's what happened in Blake. This case truly doesn't differ that much from Blake, where the problem the court found is that the only evidence was through the CAC, what was through the out-of-court interviewed statements. In this case, the only evidence about the most severe allegations, including the rape, is through the out-of-court statements. The jury doesn't have anything tangible to compare. And if we go through the lineage that this court went through in Blake of the case law, time and time again, this court has held that it's the live testimony that has to at least be, you know, there has to be an effort for it. Because that's why the sixth, that's why 3507 doesn't run afoul of the Sixth Amendment. Because you have the, you know, Your Honor characterized it as inconsistencies. They're not inconsistent, you know, respectfully, we disagree that they're inconsistencies. Because there's nothing inconsistent that she testified regarding five of the six charges, including the rape charge.
Well, isn't she, unlike Blake, in this case, the alleged victim said that the out-of-court statements to her mother and to the CAC were true.
Absolutely. That problem was met. There's no problem with that. But
well, doesn't that create the inconsistency that opens the door for effective cross-examination?
No. We respectfully disagree with that because the other problem is she has to touch on the events. She has to touch on the events perceived.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
If I could, please.
All right.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and if it pleases the court. Well, first of all, I disagree with my colleague's representation of the record of the prosecutor in this case, sort of did not bother going along the lines of asking the victim about her CAC statement. And that's simply not supported by the record. The prosecutor, after getting direct testimony about the events preceding and what you said to your mother, moved to the CAC statement. The victim agreed that she had gone to see Buster, the interviewer, that nobody forced her to go and see Buster, and that she told Buster the truth. And she talked about the drawings. Yes, Buster showed her drawings. And then the prosecutor, on several occasions over the next several pages, asked her, now, what did you and Buster talk about? Nothing. And I will note that the trial judge, at some during her testimony before this. 820 gives a the record doesn't really show everything that needs to be known about the examination here, that there are long pauses between question and answer, that the little girl is on the stand looking like a deer in the headlights. So maybe these pages here when she's talking about being questioned about the CAC interview would last from only 28 to 35 with gaps in between. But there are long pauses between question and answer. And I think finally when the prosecutor then makes the last attempt at the bottom of page 34. Okay, do you remember if you told anybody else? Well, she told her mommy. Do you remember if you told anybody else what Eric did? No. Is that no, you didn't tell anybody? Or no, you did not remember? I don't remember. And I think after this fourth attempt, the prosecutor then moved the CAC interview into evidence. So I disagree strenuously with my colleague's version of that. You have to realize that the girl is simply not going to testify about the subject matter of the CAC interview.
Well, Mr. Donovan, what's your position with respect to incidents that occur over several days? If there's a statement that covers 3 days and you ask the witness about day one, and does the statement come in with regard to all 3 days, or is there an obligation to talk about all 3 days with the witness? Try to.
But I'm assuming this would be three incidents rather than one continuous incident.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. Each incident you have to testify about that particular incident, it would seem to me, unless there's somehow some continuing here lasting over this period.
So how did that happen in this case? You've just heard the defendant argue that the witness talked about what happened at night when the movie was shown in the bedroom, but that there were other charges that the witness attributed to other days.
No, that's incorrect. This happened one time. The mother, Mrs. Smith, was very clear that and she did not leave the child alone with Eric except for this one occasion. She worked the night shift at the plant. And on this occasion, apparently the evening child care center closed early. She asked Eric to pick her up, which Eric did, and that's when this happened. The next day, when Mrs. Smith was brushing her daughter's hair, is when Eric made her statement to her mother about the nasty movie, about the honking sound, and about Eric exposing himself to her. Very upset and confronted Eric, and Eric then ran out, said something like, I didn't need it, and ran out, and wasn't arrested for another year because of him. But this, and the CAC interview, the same thing has all happened in one period of time, over a course of several hours. It was probably span the time. One day to the next, because it went over midnight. But I believe Mrs. Smith's shift was up at 2 a.m.
But it was one uninterrupted set of events.
One uninterrupted. They started out in the living room, at trial. Erica said that the defendant, or not Erica, Dawn, said the defendant, Eric, and Joe Brown, who was deceased by the time of trial, were watching the nasty movie and making the humping sounds, and people were humping on the nasty movie. And then she went into the bedroom and got in bed, and Eric followed her in and lay down in bed next to her. This is her direct testimony. Lay down in bed next to her and put his private on her leg. So that was her direct testimony. Of course, I've already gone over what he told her mother. And then at the CAC interview,
You mean rape? The main charge was rape in the first degree.
Rape in the first degree. Now, that was the penetration by Eric's penis of the victim Dawn's mouth.
So even though the indictment alleges in each count a time span between January 1st, 2008 and January 15, 2008, there's only one day that the testimony shows.
Judging from the trial testimony, which I've looked at, everything seems to tie in with the January 14th, 15th, that evening. Trooper Smith got the call that night, which was the 15th, and then the CAC interview was set up. Now, why did the prosecutor in this case, and I did not have the prosecutor, why she decided to go with the lengthy time span, I don't know. There may be other reasons for that. There may have been other evidence that could come out of trial about some other incident or other, but certainly at trial here, everything involved is one incident that, as far as I can figure out from the testimony of all concerned, was the night of January 14, 15, I believe. I relied, as the court has noted, heavily on Daly these days, which was the most recent time this court has considered the 3513. That's some lengthy. And the facts of this case, while the direct testimony consisted of the victim saying that the defendant, and this was a prosecution for three counts of rape, and the direct testimony was that the defendant tried to touch her butt with his wee-wee, and that was about it. And there's no testimony whatsoever, no questions were asked about the CA's interview at all. And this court held in Daly that this was, but noted the difference between 3507 requiring testimony, direct questions at least about the statement itself, about the statement in addition to the events perceived, and that second requirement being left out of 3513, and the court said, well, we don't have to solve this ambiguity, whether the General Assembly intended this to eliminate that requirement, because here the statement was videotaped, as the statement was in this case, and in essence, the jury can look at the statement and make their own minds up. This is because it's videotaped. This serves the purpose of direct examination regarding the making of the statement. You can see that it's voluntary. And in this case, the defendant did testify that the statement was made voluntarily, that she made the statement, that she told the truth. So the testimony here did, in fact, certainly touch on the statement itself. She simply refused to talk about the contents of the statement. Now, I suppose at some point...
Mr. Donovan, yes. If this, as occurred here, the CSC statement was videotaped, your point is that under Daly, the statement itself touches on the statement. That is, once you know the child victim acknowledges that she gave the statement, that touches on the statement. And the videotape itself touches on the events perceived. Is that your argument?
No, Your Honor. I think that testimony regarding the events perceived is a requirement. And I think the court said that remains a requirement. That 3507 requirement remains a requirement of 3513.
Well, the events perceived are the events that were related to the interviewer in the videotape. So what exactly are we talking about here? Does all of that testimony have to be replicated in the direct examination at trial?
No, and this gets into another question of exactly what does touch on mean. And this court has been very flexible on that requirement. As long as the questions are asked, even if the, as in Johnson, for example, there was the elderly victim had a failure of memory, as long as the questions are asked on direct examination, 3507 does not require any particular quality of the answer, which I think is this court's jurisprudence on 3507. I noted in the three cases decided in July. The one that was reversed was the one in which the questions were not asked. Not because the witnesses were turned. I mean, it wasn't reversed because the witnesses were turned over, and this court has dealt over and over and over again with turned over witnesses and denied making the statements, denied the truthfulness.
Well, ultimately, based on what I've just heard you say, your position and the appellant's position on what the law is the same. The difference is your concept of the record as opposed to the appellant's concept of the record. Isn't that fair to say?
Yes.
The appellant says, you're right, Mr. Prosecutor, you have to touch on the events perceived. And it doesn't matter about the quality of the answer, but the questions have to be asked. And their point is the questions weren't asked here. And your point is they were. It's just the issue is the response may not measure up to the quality one would want, but there's no requirement that there be a qualitative answer or a qualitative assessment of the answer. When the jury hears it, the jury can decide whether the statement was true or whether the witness is prevaricating at trial. Isn't that fair?
That's certainly my point. I don't want to put words in my colleague's mouth. I think they would like a better. I think their position is a better quality of answer. That the direct testimony has to touch on the actual crimes themselves, maybe even establish elements of the crime. Here, if I understand, they're saying that here the child, for example, never said on direct testimony that the defendant put his fingers in her mouth. Now, that's the main element of USC first. The trial said the defendant put his private against her leg. Obviously, the child established there was some sexual malfeasance going on, but she didn't, in her direct testimony in front of the jury, her live testimony, did not establish the elements of USC or rape in the first degree. And I think that's where we do have a point of departure here, which is why I said that 3507. And my reading of this court's jurisprudence is that, the questions must be asked, but 3507 does not require any particular quality of the answer, so long as the declarant is questioned about the events perceived and question number 3507 about the making of the out-of-court statement itself, including whether it was true. Sometimes the clerks say no, I lie. Whether it was voluntary, in the case the clerk said no, the police threatened it. You know, so it's not particular any. The clerk is asked the question, and the clerk can then say no, it was a lie, and it was a forced lie.
Well, let me interrupt you because I think this is where opposing counsel is coming from. If you ask a witness, tell me, did something bad happen to you on Halloween night? And the witness says, yeah, something bad happened to me on Halloween night, and gives some description of it. But the CAC interview talks about something that happened on Labor Day weekend that was also a little bit different in terms of it being some sexual contact, but it was at a noticeably different time, and it was a different type of sexual contact. Are the answers to the first questions in the courtroom sufficient to bring in this tape that describes a whole different situation, and the only thing in common is that it's the same victim and the same defendant?
I would say no, quite frankly. Now, without further questioning, you will explain that discrepancy, and that would be on direct examination. Well, didn't you say to the buster that this was some other guy? And that would maybe even work that out, because it sounded to me like talking, from the hypothetical that we're talking about two entirely separate incidents.
So your position is the CAC interview only relates to events on the night that went from the 14th to the 15th.
Yeah.
And to the extent the defendant is suggesting it covered a broader period of time, the defendant is has misread the record.
I believe so. This is my reading of the record that it occurred on this particular night, and that all questions asked were about this. Now, about this particular incident, one specific incident. Now, and I based that in large measure on the fact that Mrs. Smith was adamant that she never.
But going back to Justice Berger's question, no matter what the mother testified, the question is, using Justice Berger's example, and does the CAC interview refer to Halloween and Labor Day?
No. She was too young. She was only 4 years old.
I mean, anything like that.
No. This was a week later. The actual interview, the first interview was scheduled, what, 2 days later, but they didn't show up for some reason. But judging from the other, you know, the timeline from the disclosure and when Mrs. Smith asked the defendant Russell to pick up Dawn, it seems to me that there's a pretty specified jump at that particular meeting. That's what all the time.
Mr. Donovan.
One theme that runs through this, and
part Mr. of the Donovan.
Testimony is that this all began.
Question.
Yeah.
Does the state's position depend in any way on a distinction between Section 3507 and Section 3513?
No. I think here the witness direct testimony did touch upon the statement. It could. The judge felt that because the victim did not testify at all about the contents of the statement, that's where she stopped. She refused to talk about it. Refused to talk about the contents of the statement. Because of that, the 3507 requirement, the second 3507 requirement was not satisfied. I disagree with that. So the court then, trial judge then went and said, spot 3513 doesn't have that requirement, therefore I'm going to allow it in, inside videotape, and we can all look at it and as the court said in Daly, and make our own judgment. But there's one other point I would make. I think in her various statements, one fact that's holding them together is that this all begins with the movie. And Joe and the defendant watching the nastier, dirtier, bad movie and making the humping sound and this, that, and the other thing, which sort of indicates that this is all the beginning is all of this. Now, what happens after? Well, maybe in the bedroom, maybe talks about different kinds of things happen, but all have the same beginning, which is with the bad movie and the humping sounds and so on. The court has no further questions. I see my time is about it.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Justice Berger's example is actually directly on point with what's going on here. And contrary to my colleague, I believe the record is best shown with court exhibit number one. And the complainant is asked whether these events happened on one occasion. Her response is no. So the record is rather clear. There's no testimony on it because she wasn't asked by the prosecutor. But as far as the Halloween and Labor Day, that's precisely what's going on here. Some of the events are happening on one day. She's asked about the rape allegation. Did it happen on the same day? Her response is no. If the court wants to review that, the CAC interview is in the record. Actually, the exact location would be 15 minutes. About 15 minutes in and it goes for about 10 or 20 minutes there.
Was that argued by trial counsel?
Yes, and that brings up another point, Your Honor. What the record shows is that the prosecutor and the court they were not responding to the objection by defense counsel. Defense counsel was precisely part. I see my time is up. If I can finish.
Finish the answer to Justice Ridley's question.
Sure. Thank you. The prosecutor and the judge were in the landscape of 3513 and whether the statements touched or whether the testimony touched on the statements. The defense counsel objection was precisely to the argument that we have these material allegations about rape in here, she's not touching on them, where's the testimony, and it wasn't there.
But I understand that the testimony was inadequate to touch on the charges, but the point about different days, did the trial counsel argue that the alleged victim is, and the prosecutors only asked about one date when there are really two or three?
No, I think it was a general objection to the admission, totally.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.